This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, a return engagement with Nick Kullerstrom, who is an historian of science and a student of events in England. He is the author of Terror on the Tube. He has been following the recent inquest into what happened on 7/7 in the UK. Nick, it's a real pleasure to have you back.
Likewise, Jim. It's great to be back on your show again.
Tell us, what has been going on? How long have these hearings been taking place? Do you think they're being conducted in a suitable fashion?
And that may be difficult for your American listeners to follow, Jim, but it's taken 5 years to get an inquest into the events of what happened on July the 7th, 2005, and it's finally began, and it's excluded a priori the four alleged young bombers. So we don't get their view. An inquest is about looking at the cause of death, how people die, and this is going on for 5 whole months. So this is a terrifically detailed, as it were, overview of what happened, which totally presupposes the judgment of the cause of death, namely that the four young bombers did it. There can be no doubt in that, and the police who are giving evidence have arranged all of the presentations to that end.
Nick, this is shocking. Absolutely shocking. This is like the Warren Commission conducting its investigation based on the premise that Lee Oswald was the assassin, or the 9/11 Commission conducting its investigation on the basis of the presumption that 19 Islamic fundamentalists under the control of Osama bin Laden in a cave off in Afghanistan had brought about the events of 9/11.
Yeah, well, it is shocking. And I wrote a letter to the judge, Lady Justice Hallett, saying that I thought it was quite wrong to have a no-jury inquest in which basically she is just listening to police storytelling for 5 months. But that's the way it works in this country, and we, as it were, just have to put up with that. And having said that, I think there's quite a bit coming out from our point of view concerning how this event was constructed and perpetrated, which did involve rogue elements of the state.
Very, very good. Just for background for our listeners, Maud Dibb produced a video, a documentary called 7/7 Ripple Effect, that you can access on the internet. It runs about an hour, as I recall, Nick, and it's quite brilliant.
Yeah. Now, I've had a bit of a change of heart while listening to this inquest, Jim. As you may remember, year before, when I was writing my book, I was a bit sceptical whether these four lads ever really made it up to London, for the simple reason that there was no decent, credible CCTV footage and no credible witnesses in London who was prepared to say they saw them. Whereas Maud Dibb alleged that the four did go up to London and were late for the appointment due to all the trains being delayed. They were part of this terror drill. They thought they were cooperating with the state, and they then ran off, some of them, going to way out in East London, a place called Canary Wharf, where they were gunned down. Now, I've been startled. On the 13th, on the third day of this inquest, they showed a load of CCTV, unedited, of Hasib Hussain. He's one of the four young alleged bombers, in King's Cross from about 5 to 9 onwards for 25 minutes. And I was finally convinced that he really, really was at King's Cross on that morning, pottering around, wondering what to do. And I think a lot of the evidence that's coming out in this inquest, although the state doesn't realise it, is actually vindicating Maud Dibb's ripple effect. And may I also add, Jim, that on my website, I've done a thing about recent testimony about the Canary Wharf story, and I've got quite a lot of people signing up, posting stuff saying, corroborating the early stories of Canary Wharf, which was indeed in the British news about 11 o'clock in the morning, of people as alleged terrorists being gunned down there, as immediately following the terror events in the middle of London.
By all means, tell everyone where they can find that website.
Oh, it's just terrorontheTube.co.uk. And do please post a message. I'll be happy to post up whatever you want, however much you want to disagree with what I'm saying.
All right.
Please express your forthright view.
TerrorontheTube.co.uk?
Yeah.
Okay, very good, very good.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you're encouraging our listeners to post their opinions there. I think that's excellent.
Do please, yeah. Okay, yeah. So we also have a story of the CCTV being continually cut off whenever it looks like something important or interesting is going to happen. The police keep having to admit, oh no, that's funny, the CCTV has gone dead just then. With Hasipur saying, when he's pottering around King's Cross, and we presume, for readers unfamiliar with the story, that they've reached King's Cross too late for this drill they're supposed to participate in. And Hasib was saying he's got separated from the others, he's pottering around, wondering what to do, vainly trying to telephone his friends when they're supposedly, because he can see that something's been blown up, something terrible has happened, the crowds are streaming out of King's Cross, and yet he's still trying to ring them. He obviously believes they're still alive. And then he goes out into a McDonald's, and we see the man, the owner of McDonald's, instructed to switch off the CCTV. So there's no CCTV when he goes in. Likewise, the buses he's supposed to have got, 91 and 30 buses, there's no CCTV working on these buses. And that keeps being the story at strategic points.
What could be a more blatant indication of guilt? This is what's called consciousness of guilt under the law here in the U.S., Nick, where people take actions that clearly are indicative that they're aware of their guilt and they're trying to conceal it. This is very clumsy.
It is, yes, and that's a good point, Jim. What reminded, I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of the thing on the 22nd, 2 weeks after, when Menzies, a totally innocent electrician, was gunned down the Stockwell tube, and all the CCTV was then, as it were, got rid of by the police. The people who owned Metronet, who owned the CCTV, insisted it was quite right when they handed it over to the police, and the police said, oh, no, that's sorry, it's wiped clean. Just as they say with the 30 bus, that's the one that blew up in Tavistock Square, they say, oh, that's funny, none of the CCTV is working. Oh, what a disappointment.
This is disgusting, Nick, absolutely disgusting.
Yes, it may remind you of, obviously, what happened with 9/11, when at the airports, 9/11,
and the Pentagon, where they had some 83 cameras that should have shown what happened, but they only released later 5 frames under duress. Eventually, 3 that had clearly been edited, and they've never released the others, no doubt because it would refute the official story.
Yeah, right. Likewise, and also, I'm sure some of your discerning listeners will remember the story of Lady Di, her last minutes with Dodi in Paris. All the CCTV is suddenly not functioning, their last drive along the Paris highway, and the last glimpse we ever see with them is when they're coming out of the Ritz Hotel, where the CCTV is working. So somehow, when the authorities are doing a major operation, they have the ability to switch off this CCTV. This is a sinister feature of the world we're living in.
Do you believe they're actually shutting them off in all these cases, or are they simply editing the tape?
Ah, well, that's a good point.
They might be shutting them off, because that at least guarantees there isn't even any tape to edit.
Yeah, well, in the case of the Hasib Hussain going into the McDonald's, we actually have part of the official transcript, which, by the way, is totally going online. You get long official transcripts every day of this inquest. With a picture of the manager of the McDonald's going over. This is about 9:20 when Hasib Hussain is just going in there. Actually switching off his CCTV. Britain is the most surveyed country in the world. I mean, we get photographed about several hundred times, is it a week? Several hundred times a week on CCTV all the time. They're everywhere, and yet they can go off at these crucial moments.
Yeah, what good is it to have this massive surveillance system if it's not going to reveal telling events like these? You know, these are the crucial events for which the system exists.
Yeah, okay, Jim, if I may give you one more example of the CCTV going off. One of the other conspirators called Lindsay, Jermaine Lindsay, okay? Now, we've had a couple of fascinating glimpses of his last moments on Earth. First of all, he arrives at Luton Station. He drives up in his car from Aylesbury, and he arrives a bit earlier than the others. And he parks his car before the others have arrived, and what does he do? He nods off to sleep, right? This is a suicide bomber, and a lady comes with a parking ticket, to give him a parking ticket. It's about just before 6 in the morning, and sees that the driver is fast asleep. Now, how likely is that for, you know?
Extraordinarily improbable. You're about to blow yourself up. Your adrenaline's going to be pumping like mad. The last thing you're going to be able to do is sleep.
Totally, right. Okay, so he's pretty relaxed. And then he turns up at King's Cross, and at King's Cross, one thing fascinating came out from this inquest, I think the police didn't quite realise what I was saying, they had a witness describing all the preparations that were going on at King's Cross before the bombs blew up, okay? There was a whole lot of control mechanisms put in place, a whole lot of extra police were seen filing into King's Cross, and the control going on looked very peculiar, and it was a bit, it was quite stressful for the guards who were looking after King's Cross to have this control going on. This is about quarter to nine, 8:30, before the bombs had gone off, okay? So we get this testimony, and Jermaine Lindsay, he obviously finds this all rather peculiar. This is before the bombs had gone off, okay? And he then comes up to a guard at the by the barriers, okay, and he asks to speak to the duty manager. And the guard says he's got something very important to say. And the guard says, look, can't you just speak to one of us? It's a bit difficult to get the duty manager down because of this control thing going on. So this is quite ironic that it's the control processes going on that have triggered off something in Lindsay. It suddenly begins to twig that this mock terror drill he's been asked to come up for might be something a bit different from what he thought. He might be in a very terrible situation.
Yes.
It begins to dawn upon him, okay? So he asks to speak, this guard, he insists, no, he's got to talk to the top man, that's the duty manager. And finally, this guard goes over to get the duty manager. After trying to dissuade Lindsay, he can't, he insists. And he's a bit surprised that he knows the name of this person duty manager to speak to. He goes over and gets it, and when he comes back, Lindsay has scuttled off. And those are the last words we ever get from Jermaine Lindsay. Now, I think that's very interesting. Shows that his conscience, Jermaine Lindsay's conscience working, and he's having the horrible realisation, exactly as in the ripple effect, just as in the ripple story, a horrible effect is dawning on him that this is something very different from the drill that he thought he'd volunteered to be part of, and something rather funny is happening at King's Cross. So that is a fascinating little glimpse we get of Jermaine Lindsay, and there's only slight difference from the Ripple story. It's slightly before the bombs go off that happens.
Well, what in God's name would he be doing asking to speak to the duty manager if he weren't in some very bizarre situation? This is not the conduct of a suicide bomber.
Totally. I think you put your finger on it there, Jim. It totally rules out the idea of a suicide bomber. The idea of a suicide bomber with a rather small rucksack, this guard did remember him having a rather small rucksack on his back, okay, would start wanting to talk to the duty manager. It's just totally out of the question.
Nick, I need for you to repeat that. We're having some odd interruptions in our conversation, and the point you are making is that, yes, his conduct is completely inconsistent with that of a suicide bomber when he goes to ask to speak to the duty manager. Just repeat the point, please.
Yeah, that's exactly as you said it, Jim. This shows Lindsay's conscience working, that he thought he was part of some sort of terror drill, probably getting paid a bit of money for it, and told he was helping the British state to work, and his friend Khan, people surmised that it would have been Khan that roped the three others into this wheeze, and he then starts to get a horrible sense, because he sees all these peculiar things going on at King's Cross, a whole lot of extra police coming in and a whole lot of controls being put down.
Right.
And he demands to talk to the duty manager to find out what in the hell is going on.
Right, because this is not what he signed on for.
No, but he gets frightened, I think. I think he experiences terror as he begins to, the awful implications begin to sink in, and then he bolts off before the duty manager arrives.
Very, very, very fair response, because if the duty manager sees him and knows who he is, he's likely to be apprehended or killed on the spot.
Exactly, yeah.
I think I can understand his desire to speak to him, but I can also understand why, once he realizes that the duty manager has to be part and parcel of this whole scam, that he had better vacate the premises as soon as possible.
Yeah, you got it, Jim, yeah. And I think that also corroborates our general picture with the ripple effect, that these lads want to bolt. They just want to get the hell out of this place. which seems to be what they do. So I think this, what we're hearing, my view, what we're hearing in the inquest is very compatible with Muad'Dib's story, which, as you pointed out, was a bit of a work of genius.
Nick, let's go back just a step or two and explain how these four lads were in one part of town and to get over to these various tube stops where they thought they were simulating, pretending to be suicide bombers. They missed a connection and they were unable to arrive at the tube stops at the right time.
Yeah, they would have had to get into King's Cross by around 8:30, and in order to get these destinations in time. And what I think I found very dramatic was the way loads of CCTV from Hasib Hussein started appearing at 8:55, and from that they had 25 minutes of fairly continuous record. This is all the police had been able to amass from all the different sources. They had 25 minutes continuous recording of Hasib Hussein, and I see that as evidence that he wasn't actually pottering around King's Cross for the previous half hour. I know they tried to make out they got one or two witnesses, but it seems to me this is compatible with a late train arriving, and he therefore comes into view at that point of some minutes before nine.
Nick, tell us, where was their point of origin heading into these various tube stops where the terror drills were supposed to take place, but actually which went live?
Sorry, the point of origin?
Yeah, where did they get on the tube originally from their part of town? Weren't they all together?
Oh, right. Well, they have several stage journeys. They come down from Luton. They arrive too late at Thames Link, which is about 5 or 10 minutes walk away from the main underground at King's Cross. It's very important to understand there is that stroll they have to go through. The Thames Link they arrive at is not the underground. And they need, say, 10 minutes to walk across, and they then have to jump onto the Piccadilly line and Circle line. And it's become very clear at this inquest, with all the very, very detailed and horrifying, horrendous accounts of people being blown up and mutilated, which the inquest is going into in gory detail, that nobody has any memory of seeing a Muslim. There's continual attempts to make out as if, oh, that's where the bomber was standing. The police have put questions to the witnesses, where the bomber was standing. But there's absolutely nobody who will give a testimony to seeing a Muslim with a big rucksack, fiddling about with a big rucksack. And it's made it absolutely clear they haven't got any CCTV whatsoever of any of these four on the London Underground. This is the final showdown, this inquest.
Yeah.
And there's just nothing there about those lads. If you like, I could...
Go ahead.
Talk about the astonishing evidence that's coming out with the Allgate. The last 2 weeks they've been going over the kind of blast that went on the Allgate. That's in the City of London.
Wait a minute, Nick. I want to make a couple points very clear for the audience. Number one, what you're explaining is that there's no evidence, no witness evidence that places any of the bombers at the tube stops or on the trains where these explosions took place.
Correct. Yeah,
This is precisely analogous to Elias Davidson, Davidson's article, in which he establishes that the United States government now, has never been able to show that any of the alleged 19 hijackers were aboard any of the four commercial carriers, that they simply haven't been able to prove it.
Yeah, yeah. It is totally analogous to that, yeah.
Now you're saying they start off at Luton, but they had to make a connection, and the train where they were making the connection was late. Can you go over that?
Well, yeah, this was my great discovery. This is how I got catapulted into the whole story. I and a friend went up about 6 weeks after the bombing had taken place to Luton, and we got the official database of all the trains that morning from Luton and King's Cross, and we got testimonies from a load of commuters, and we pieced together the actual train times, which were all delayed by 20-25 minutes, and the key cancellation, which Muad'Dib says is like the hand of God, of the train that had been planned that they were going to get onto. See, this whole thing had been carefully pre-planned, very carefully pre-planned. They would all get onto the 7:40 train at Luton, and that would get them down to London by about 8:30.
So as the train at Luton was the one that was delayed?
All the trains were delayed, but the key train they were supposed to have got on was actually cancelled, the 7:40 that morning.
It was cancelled?
Yeah.
You can't do better than that, Nick. They can't have come into town on a cancelled train.
No, they couldn't. But it took the government one whole year to admit this, because all their official accounts were saying that the four had come in on the 740. And not only that, but there have been witnesses on the train that had seen them on that 740 train. And now what they're trying to tell you, what they're telling, they are telling the public at the inquest, is they're trying to make out they got the earlier train, 724, and they're saying they got witnesses on that earlier train now that saw them.
In other words, they're rigging the testimony.
They must be rigging the testimony. They've shifted all their witnesses onto an earlier train. Not only that, but they've now come up with a whole lot of CCTV allegedly showing the four quickly whisking through the Luton station and getting onto the platform by 7:22. Now, if they've got all that CCTV allegedly, or about 7:23 or 4 or something, if they've got all that CCTV with timestamps on it, allegedly showing the four getting to that early, catching that early train, how come all of the government and all of the police and all of the media could be saying they got the 740 for a whole year? The only possible logical conclusion is that CCTV with timestamps did not exist at that earlier time.
Yeah, it's been fabricated. It's fake. Yeah. It's fake tape. There's no doubt.
Fake tape. And that's why they could only produce it 3 years later. We need to realize this timed CCTV at Luton has only appeared in the summer of 2008. There was a so-called July 7th trial when they came out with this. And I think that's just too late in the day. So I think the ripple effect is withstanding the test of time here. And the four are definitely up in London, or at least we've definitely got evidence of two of them. Other two might have been there as well. This is now looking like the most likely story, Jim.
Now, am I correct in believing that they're all four dead at this point in time?
Well, we presume that all four were really, really dead by the end of July the 7th. Yeah,
by the end of the day. Not that they died in the tube explosions or on the bus, but the authorities made a point of making sure they weren't going to be around to contradict the official story by killing them, some of which took place on Canary Wharf, if we are to believe the stories that are coming out now.
Yeah, I mean, we'd all like to hear a bit more from the relatives about whether the four bodies were intact. There are certainly persistent stories that the bodies the relatives were given back were intact and not blown to bits. This may be one reason why they don't want any words from the families of the four. They've not allowed any families to be present at this five-month inquest.
Isn't there some journalist who has the courage, the integrity to interview them and find out and publish it?
Absolutely not. You must be joking. We don't have journalists like that in this country. There's no Muslim group. You might think there was even a Muslim group somewhere that would interview them and even just put it on a website, but there isn't. There's just a little group of rather demoralized truth investigators who try to find out these things.
Nick, and when you talk about the Muslim group, I had such high hopes they were going to turn out for the symposium on debunking the war on terror on the 14th of July at Friend's House. And as you had predicted, in spite of Declan and Lola's best efforts, and Declan was going all over the city hitting mosque after mosque, he must have hit hundreds of mosques in the several months prior to this event. To the best of my knowledge, not a single Muslim attended that event.
No, right. I mean, that is why Muslims make such ideal, demonized sort of such an ideal demonized enemy, that they are fairly quiet and meek and submissive in a collective sense. They don't express any view. There's no journal of theirs. There's no media, TV or radio station of theirs that will express a dissident view, however quietly. It just won't happen.
And I was presenting a talk myself entitled "Our Wars in Iraq and Afghanistan Justified by 9/11," and explaining that the 14 Islamic fundamentalists were purely patsies, and most of the story told by the government in every essential respect was fabricated, phony, faked.
Yeah.
Anyone who wants to hear it can go to noliesradio.org/archive/21621 and see precisely what I'm talking about. Nick, it's such a great pleasure to have you here. We're going to take our first break, and then we're going to continue this conversation with Nick Kullerstrom. We'll be right back.
Don't dig no Pakistanis taking all the people's jobs.
Oh, get back!
Considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Besser. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, the author of Terror on the Tube, Nick Kohlerstrom, who is also an historian of science and whom I hold in high esteem and whom I am very grateful has been following very closely the inquest taking place now of some 5 months' duration into the events of 7/7, where it is absolutely crystal clear that the British government was responsible for the terror on the tube, that it was a fabricated event, and that their patsies, four young Muslim men, were not even present on the tube at the time these explosions took place because of a delay. The train they were supposed to catch from Luton had been canceled. Nick, This is stunning, stunning stuff.
Yeah, Jim. If we could perhaps move on to the coach at Aldgate where the blast happened.
Yes.
I think your listeners might be interested here. They brought out a diagram. I know it's a bit macabre, but this whole inquest is a bit macabre, of the dead bodies, and they are, as it were, symmetrical around a line down the centre of the coach. Now, if I may just remind your listeners, the Aldgate coach, there was a well-known character called Bruce Late who gave testimony. He and his dancing partner, Crystal, gave testimony, and Crystal describes the terrific sense of electrocution, electric shock she felt before and during the blast, and a terrific roar. Both described a terrific roar, which they would never forget, and Bruce Late also describes how he didn't see any before the blast. He remembers who was in the coach. There was no Muslim or no rucksack in sight. He clearly said that, and he also clearly said that after it, when he woken up, regained consciousness, he could see the floor of the coach sticking upwards. Okay,
yes.
The metal had been twisted upwards. That's a well-known quote. All of which had sort of disappeared by the time he came to give evidence at the inquest.
Which, of course, is indicative of a blast located underneath the floor of the coach, not above it, in which case the blast would have gone downward, and the floor would be reaching down, not sticking up.
Yeah, so I think we've got testimonies, the way I see it, of the front part of that coach at, I think it's the second coach on the Aldwych train, of some sort of blast which created a kind of rift or valley down the central part of the coach, and rather than of a blast coming out from a specific corner where this rucksack was said to be deposited. The police alleged that the rucksack was deposited in a corner by the gates, but I think the pattern of the dead bodies they showed is much more spread out along the central line, and also there's a lot of testimonies of people getting their feet blown off, and I know it's a bit macabre, feet and legs blown off rather than their arms, and this again indicates something to do with
a blast from beneath.
Yeah.
Does it look as though the explosives were distributed down the middle of the train, underneath the train, that they were all concentrated in one place?
Well, that's a bit the impression that I get from the testimonies. Something comes up from underneath the floor, and I think the diagram of the damage done that we've been shown helps us to appreciate this. But let's realize we've never ever been shown any proper picture of the coach or the whole and the hole made by the blast.
How can anybody be dumb enough to buy the official story, Nick? This is all so disgusting. It's also blatant. It's also in your face. It's obvious that the official story can't possibly be true, and therefore that the government, which is covering it up, has to be the culpable party.
Well, I sort of think it is, yeah. But there's terrific media unanimity in this country, which, for example, in every account of this experience of what's happening in the coach at Aldgate, they will always say, I think it's Tanweer, Shehzad Tanweer, Tanweer was in this corner, and they will always reiterate that as if it were a fact.
Well, in other words, they've got the imaginary bomber, so they're situating him in a specific location. This is just like on 9/11, Nick. They were claiming that these hijackers were in specific seats on these phantom flights.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, whatever happened, it somehow blew out a whole lot of the electrical power of East London Underground. That's what's been admitted. And let me also tell you one other interesting thing that's come out from this inquest, and that is the timing. When did this blast happen at Aldgate? Well, we've also always said it happened at 11 minutes to 9, and a slightly sort of, conjectural idea, is this meant to be the 11-9-9-11 link-up, okay? Now, at this inquest, they came out with very exact timing. They said they got atomic clocks somehow for calibrating exactly what happened during these moments.
Atomic clocks?!
Well, that's what they said.
Go ahead.
They reckon they got second accuracy in which they tried to reconstruct this sequence of the blast, okay? Now, all of which is the first bomb that goes off. So all three bombs on the tube are within 50 seconds of each other, right? They're within a space of about 40 or 50 seconds, which is strongly connected with the idea of synchronous remote detonation.
Yes.
You've got bombs going off, it doesn't, within 50 seconds, that does not argue very well for separate anguished suicide bombers at their last moment, okay?
Oh, yeah, sure. Some are going to hesitate. They're going to be realizing they're going to blow themselves up. This is the last, breath they're going to breathe. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why they shouldn't be going all be going off at the same time.
Yeah.
Nick, I lost you. Are you there? Nick, I lost
you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, repeat it now. Repeat what you're saying. I said there are all kinds of reasons why there shouldn't be perfectly synchronized explosions taking place.
Yeah. If we make the analogy with the Madrid bombs, there you had 11 bombs, I think it was 11, went off within a 3-minute interval, and that was remote detonation. Everyone said it was remotely detonated. Nobody pretended there were suicide bombers blowing themselves up. That was the year before, 2004. And I think there is an analogy here. And let's remember that within the first week of the July 7th bombing, the first few days, the experts, real genuine experts, were saying that they had found timing devices, that the events were synchronous, and that they had military-grade explosive, which they'd found traces of. So the original story coming out of the July 7th, after the July 7th event, did not involve suicide bombers. It was the synchronous blasts were connected with the timers, which they claimed had been found. And military-grade explosive. Now, all that stuff went out the window once the government started with its suicide bomber story up in Leeds, but it's not clear how anyone can dismiss the view of real experts, and I suggest we should take that initial view as really the most reasonable.
Yes, that it was military-grade explosives, which would not have been accessible to these young Islamic men in this part of London. They wouldn't have had access to that. And timers, where it's doubtful how they could possibly have created them, they would have had their own very crude form of initiation that they themselves would have had to set off.
Yeah, right. Okay, now, what we were told at the inquest, I think this is of slight interest, it's the nearest second, it was 11 minutes to 9:00 seconds. So the timing to the second of the Aldgate blast, that were very emphatic about this, and also that was also the collapse of power in East London Underground, whole lot of East London, the electric power blacked out, was 11 minutes to 9:00 seconds. So this then puts us in the question, do we believe in these number games? Do we believe that 9/11 is in any way expressed at this timing. For example, as fairly well known, the Madrid bomb on the 11th of March was 9/11 days after 9/11. Do we want to take seriously these kind of number games or not? I don't know if you have a view on this, Jim.
Well, yeah, I think that the numbers are very important to the plotters. I mean, they do it all deliberately. It's part of their signature.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So I think it has to be taken seriously. These things cannot be all coincidental.
Yeah, okay. Now, the Mumbai bombing a year later, that was also in July, and just let me make an analogy here, that was on the 11th of July, that's 11/7, okay?
Yeah.
And when ABC News was announcing this, it said the bombs went off over a period of 11 minutes. There were seven bombs went off at Mumbai over a period of 11 minutes.
So 11/7 on 7/11.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just suggesting, I'm not very sure about this, that somebody might be playing number games and the very precise indication shows that these are fairly high-tech capabilities to blow out not only a tube coach, but much the power of the East London Underground on very precisely 11 minutes to 9, and that the inquest further stated that the three blasts were timed within 50 seconds around 11 minutes to 9. That's what they said.
11
okay?
minutes to 9.
Yeah. Now, some people try to make out, sort of scoffing at this a bit, as if the inquest is being conspiratorial, as if the inquest is trying to weave some connection with 9/11. But I'd like to suggest, having watched the barrister, Mr. Hugo Keith, giving all this stuff, he's not the slightest bit interested or tuned into conspiracy theory in that way, that there's absolutely no way he would want to weave an argument which made the timing of the London bombs link up with 9/11. He just wouldn't do that at all. That's totally out of the question, I suggest. So what I'm suggesting is that the phenomenon is giving us this deliberate timing, and it's giving us synchronous bomb blasts, and I think a sensible view, which I hope people will come to take, is that this is a bit similar to the Madrid bombings, where you had synchronous bomb blasts remotely detonated. These are remotely detonated events, and there were absolutely no young bombers there. That's just a phantom. It's a phantasm.
This is stunning stuff, Nick. I want to remind our audience that you have a website, terrorontheTube.co.uk, not com, .co.uk.
Yeah,
where you can get more of Nick's writing and reflections on these matters.
Right. Okay, Jim. Could I perhaps give another little insight that's emerged?
Yes.
Up in Luton.
Yes.
Okay. Now, there's a research team that call themselves the United Seventh Truth Campaign, and they're sort of quite visible as submitting material to this inquest. And they put out a good news story on their website, which is they've been analysing the CCTV at Luton. Now, remember I earlier mentioned about Lindsay, how he was he was up there early and he fell asleep in his car, okay?
Yeah.
Now, about an hour later, we get the car arriving driving in from way up north, Leeds. They've done a two-hour journey down, and they're meeting up with the other guy, Lindsay, who's driven over from a place called Aylesbury, and they both meet and park together. They both drive within a couple of minutes to the same point in the car park. This is about 10 to 7, okay? And just before that happens, you see a Jaguar, which is a very posh British car, just parked about 50 yards away in the same car park, the same bay of the car park. And just the exact moment when the car drives in coming down from Leeds, the lights go on of this Jaguar car.
Really?
And as the car comes into park, the Jaguar then turns round, and it's pretty obviously going to park next to the other two. And then just as it's about to turn round, park next to it, you see, zoom, the CCTV goes off. So we've got several minutes of this Jaguar turning round and looking just like it's going to park next to the others, and the fact that it starts moving within seconds of the car arriving from Leeds, I think, shows they're in mobile phone contacts, okay? So this is the minder. You know, these patsies put up for a job, they have a minder who's looking after them to make sure they do what they're told, and they don't quite realise what's going on. So this guy in a Jaguar, I think this is quite interesting, because the British people are never going to believe that an Al-Qaeda operative is driving a Jaguar.
Yes.
A Jaguar is similar to the British aristocracy. You know?
Yes.
And also, the July 7th people have also noticed that there was a so-called dry run 10 days earlier, on the 28th of June, okay, when three of them turned up and went up to London and potted around London for the day. And they arrived then about an hour later in the Luton car park, and there's also some CCTV released of that, and they've shown that the same Jaguar is parked in the very same spot for the dry run.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, so they've got this smart-looking Jaguar car parked at the same spot in the car park at these two events.
What kind of a car Peter Power drives?
Well, yes. Anyway, I think this is a very good kind of missing link in the jigsaw puzzle.
Yes.
And it's helping us to get a picture of these four being looked after, or what they
managed,
thought.
Managed, handled, yes. Manipulated.
Handled.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that this Jaguar is obviously not mentioned by any of the British media, but it is there up on the web. And I think that gives a nice angle, help us understand what was going on at Luton Station that morning. And
So it's so improbable that you'd have this very sophisticated, expensive vehicle located right there at those times.
At those
times, two different occasions, including the dry run. I mean, it's got to be involved. There's just no question about it.
Yeah, I think that has to show a connection.
And they're probably cutting off the camera because it might reveal who actually was driving the car.
Yeah. I think it's a disgrace that the police haven't got the number of the car and followed it up a bit.
It's clear that elements of the police, no doubt at the highest level, are culpable here, that they're responsible for implementing the cover-up.
Well, I'm afraid it does look a bit that way, yeah. I mean, they're always talking about a fifth man as some sort of Al-Qaeda operative and trying to pretend it came from the Finsbury Park Mosque or whatever, but clearly there wasn't any such person.
Well, fifth man could be the driver of the Jaguar.
Exactly, yeah, this is what it's looking like.
Yeah.
Fifth man is there shown.
There was a fifth man. Unfortunately, it was the M5 handler of our four young patsies.
Yeah. Okay, well,
MI5, yeah.
Yes, so that's quite a good new angle that I think is coming out from Luton.
Tell me, before we return to the evidence and so forth, tell me a little bit about the demeanor of those who are in the audience. How much of the public is allowed to attend?
Well, the public can only come in a sort of overflow room. We just see the photograph, the film proceedings. You know,
on a delayed basis, or you seen it live?
We see it live, yeah. But you don't.
You're seeing and hearing the testimony as it's being presented, but you're not in the same room.
Yeah, it's at the Royal Court of Justice, it's a very strange event in the way that British people are carefully only given one side of the story. And not allowed to hear any debate at all.
Well, this is because it's being stage-managed. I mean, the public's being stage-managed in terms of its access to information just as much as the four patsies were being managed on their way to their unfortunate final destiny.
Yeah.
Blatant, though, Nick. This is so disgraceful. This is so obvious. This is so disgusting. I mean, listen, any lingering vestiges of confidence I've had in the UK judicial system have been completely shattered by what you've told me today.
Right. I mean, the story with Khan, for example, okay? Now, Mohammed Sid Khan, who was a very distinguished member of the Beeston community, and was looked up and almost revered by various different people as an up-and-coming figure who probably would have been in local politics if he'd been still alive, and he helped at a school, and mothers trusted him with their little girls to take him to school, pick him up in their car, and he had a gang that helped to get local kids off drugs, because there's quite a heroin epidemic around the place. And as Muhyiddin points out, his weakness would have been that he would have believed, because he was taken up to the House of Commons to be shown round by the son of Tony Benn, and his mother-in-law had also been to Buckingham Palace. So he'd got this, must have been proud of his upper crust connections. And as Muhyiddin points out, his weakness would have been that he believed he would tend to trust the police, okay?
Yeah.
So he may have been approached but in that way to help something with however it's put to him. Okay, now, I think that the police have a bit overplayed their hands here. If you remember, we were told in the wake of the bombs that his remains of his were found at three different sites, in the carriage at Edgware Road, in the carriage at Aldgate, and also in Tavistock Square.
How is that possible?
Well, people said, well, if he's blown up, I think he was claimed he was at Edgware Road Tube, okay?
Yeah.
If he's blown up at Edgware Road Tube, how can he have his remains, final remains, found at three different places?
Indeed.
Now, what the police have done now, they've added a fourth place, a fourth, okay? They've said, let me get this right, his mobile phone was found in the tunnel of Piccadilly Line. That's between King's Cross and Russell Square. That's where the train blew up. Just coming out of King's Cross. And they claim that here, not only they found his mobile phone, but that they recovered phone messages from it which told about what he'd been doing that morning. So the phone was not only survived a blast of his rucksack, but was in good enough condition to have his phone messages. Now, how can whoever you think was at was on the King's Cross Tube, how can he possibly be given the mobile phone of Khan? How can anyone possibly believe that all four, they've now got all four blast sites, they claim, have got remnants of Sid Khan?
What bizarre chain of reasoning is leading them to make such claims? I mean, it's bizarre. Very strange.
Well, it is. I mean, the basic... What's wrong here is that police are allowed to spin a story, which hasn't traditionally been the role of the police, and it shouldn't be. Traditionally, the role of the police has been to prepare material for a court hearing, okay?
Yes.
For a prosecution. And they don't have to do that now. They're at liberty to spin a story, and the story being spun, it keeps being spun, and it's becoming more and more incoherent. And I hope a time will come when it will dawn on British journalists that Khan's remains being found at four different places, that all four of the blast sites, is actually evidence that he wasn't on any of them.
Yes.
That's what it shows. It's a bit like the picture. I don't know if you remember the picture of Khan, very obviously faked at Luton, with the bars of the railing going in front of him when he should have been behind him.
Yes.
This. Some people think this might be a kind of message from the perpetrators saying, look, he wasn't here. This is a total fake.
Yes, but we have the power to do it.
But we have the power to do it, yeah. we have the power to mess with your mind in this way, and we know we can get away with it.
This body isn't like pieces of Colonel Sanders' chicken that might be found at four different locations. It was one undetached body parts. It was one person at one point in time.
Yeah.
And the idea that you'd find these parts distributed like this is just incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. What are they trying to test, the gullibility of the British public?
Yeah.
You know, how much happy horse shit are you willing to swallow?
Yeah. Well, the story of how they identified the four, which is supposed to happen on Monday the 11th of July, was supposedly involved recovering ID, you see? Unburnt ID documents of Khan, was like his wallet, were supposed to be found in Tavistock Square, which is where Hasib Hussain was supposed to be. And why would he give him his wallet?
Where the bus blew up near Tavistock Square. Yeah.
So it's supposed to have Khan's wallet. I mean, this is just getting too silly for words. I hope a time will come when the media, journalists are going to start to say, look, we're really... So far, there's only been one newspaper, let me tell you, called the Daily Mail, which has published a story, and it did it on the guise of looking at conspiracy theories, okay? It said, look, this is what Muad'Dib has said. Here is a picture of some Muslims who are taking a bit of notice of it. And on that basis, it could air, what's it called, the conspiracy views. And that is the only way in which the British public have been treated to something in the newspaper looking at an alternative view.
A derisive attitude toward what is the truth.
Well, it was somewhat respectful in a way, but it was done as conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
of the way things have happened. Yeah.
Nick, one loose end. When you talked about the electrical power going out in relation to the explosions, I presume the tubes run on an electrified rail, and therefore that suggests the bomb underneath the car took out the railing that was electrified at the time that the blast occurred.
That's a bit what it looks like, yeah. Yeah, it looks like certainly something underneath or outside the coach could knock out the electricity, whereas we can't easily imagine a bomb inside a coach doing that.
Nick, yeah. We're going to take our second break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, the author of Terror on the Tube, Nick Kullerstrom. We're discussing an inquest in the UK that's ongoing about what actually happened on 7/7, which appears designed to mislead the public and cover up the truth. We'll be right back.
Hey, Jack Blood here for WholesaleDirectMetals.com. WholesaleDirectMetals.com has been checked out by our own investigative reporting team, and they have a AAA rating by the Better Business Bureau and zero complaints in North America. You can buy gold coins, bullion, or IRAs from Wholesale Direct Metals. They are the most trusted metals broker for household and institutional investors nationwide. They have all the best prices because they keep their overhead low. That means you get the savings and you get the freedom that gold affords you at the lowest, that is the lowest discount prices anywhere today. Give them a call at 800-806-6936, 1-800-806-6936. The gold will be at your door before you know it. They are our family gold brokers, and I want you and your family to use them too. Call them and let them professionally walk you through the process. WholesaleDirectMetals.com, 800-806-6936.
Go. But oh, that magic feeling came true.
Admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it? Who did it? The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Nick Kullerstrom from the UK. He's an historian of science. He's the author of Terror on the Tube. Nick, one of the questions I wanted to ask is how the research you presented in Terror on the Tube has been affected by these hearings, and the differences between Maud Dibbs' conclusions in 7-7 Ripple Effect, which anyone can find, by the way. This is a brilliant documentary about it that you can find on the internet, and your own research. How has it been affected and brought you closer to alignment with Maud Dibbs' views?
Okay, Jim. Well, first of all, let's bear in mind that Maud Dibbs, that's Mr. Anthony Hill, is going to be on trial at Dublin at the High Court on the 11th of November. That's a few days from now. Is charged with the crime of sending his DVDs to the Kingston so-called July the 7th trial, okay? So that's an exciting event that we're all looking forward to.
Sickening.
Well, it's a rather absurd charge they put him on. Typically, Maud Dibbs replied by accusing the British Crown of being a criminal enterprise and of conspiring so forth. So
for which there's increasing evidence accumulating during the course of this hearing.
Yeah, okay, so he's kind of raising the stakes. I think he knows what he's doing. But so, coming back to your question, I had a bit of a conversion experience on the third day of this inquest that, for example, in the BBC Conspiracy Files programme on July the 7th, they scoffed at me because I was sceptical that the four had really got up to London that morning. I accepted that at least three of them had driven down to get to Luton. It seemed to me that the totally fabricated CCTV images we've been shown was indication that they hadn't actually got to London, so I couldn't quite see the ripple effect point of view. And this changed when I was allowed to see at the inquest what the British public will never see, that is totally authentic, unfiddled with CCTV. There's only two lots of totally unfiddled with authentic CCTV that I've seen pertaining to this event. One was that from the 28th of June, 10 days before, we see the whole lot of quite normal CCTV of the three coming into London. And then 25 minutes of Hasib Hussein pottering around King's Cross.
Yes.
Now, this will never be shown to the public, and what they will do is they will pixelate out all of the other people apart from Hasib Hussein, so they're not visible, and then they will just show a little ring around Hasib Hussein, which is a bit of a shame, but take it from me that this CCTV is totally authentic. I think it is, and he was really there. That's what I was convinced.
He was really there, but he most certainly was not displaying the demeanor of a suicide bomber. On the other hand, he was displaying the demeanor of someone who is gradually realizing he'd been conned, that he was being used, and that his life was now in jeopardy.
Yeah, and he was continuing trying to make the phone calls to the other three, which is, I think, is clear evidence that he was not expecting them to be blown up. He could see he was pushed out, rushed out of King's Cross along with everyone else. They were all told to get out because of the crisis of what was happening. He would have realized that something terrible had happened, realized that this terror drill wasn't quite what it's supposed to be, and he might have got a phone call from his minder instructing him what to do next, because remember, he was he's only 18 years old and very ignorant of what to do in London. And whatever he did do next, the CCTV blocks out from all the places he was supposed to have been at. So that's all we can say. So I'm saying now that, as far as I can tell, the evidence is pointing to the Ripple story as really the only one we've still got going. The official story cannot be true because of the, a whole lot of failure of the evidence at every point. Official story, I hope the British people will have the discernment to see that story fall apart. The question is, what happened to the four when they got up to King's Cross? They'd have a bit of a trouble getting out to Canary Wharf in time. It's quite a long way out, but assuming they could get there by 10:30, I'm now convinced by a whole lot of evidence that there really was that shooting. And I could point out that you, Jim, interviewed a British philosophy professor from Sheffield who had analysed the Muad'Dib story, compared it with the BBC story, and his crucial bit of evidence that he saw it was the Canary Wharf assassinations. These were clearly, the pretense was that the people they shot down were suicide bombers with bombs, and he regarded that as a key part for verifying the Muad'Dib thesis.
Nick, tell us, for the benefit of the audience, exactly what happened at Canary Wharf as Muad'Dib reconstructed and as he confirmed it.
Okay. Well, the police are allowed to shoot members of the public, and it's a terrible thing to say, under what's called Operation Kratos. Okay? Now, Operation Kratos, you have to believe that the person has got bombs on them, wearing bombs, and maybe about to blow them up. And the British public were horrified to discover, with the Menzies' assassination on the 22nd, that is something the British police had trained themselves in without consulting us, the public, without consulting Parliament. They'd taken a training from the Israeli army, for God's sake, in how to deal with terrorists, and that involved shooting in the head, I believe, people, if these certain specifications were made, that you thought they were suicide bombers. Now, that's the only condition under which they're allowed to do this, I think that's relevant to
this parallel to the doctrine of preemptive strikes in warfare, that if you're facing an imminent attack from another nation, then you're allowed to attack that nation under the rules of international law to defend yourself. So here, if you have a suicide bomber who you expect is about to blow himself up, you're justified in killing him before he can ignite his bomb.
Well, okay, but that's an ethos for the army. For the police, the idea that they are entitled under any circumstance whatever to commit murder is totally horrifying, and it undermines the idea that the police are there to prevent killings, not to perpetrate them.
Yes, yes. Oh, I agree completely. I just I was just drawing a parallel between what was the presumptive rationale for doing so.
Totally, yeah, yeah. Now, what's important about the reports we get, what Hamlet Canary Wharf, I think we get one report of two people being shot down, another one of three, and then there's various reports of a whole lot of people being told they're not allowed to come out of buildings, thousands of people, in fact, and also to stay away from the windows, to go on one side of the building, not look out the windows, to sort of...
curtail the witnesses.
Yeah, go tell the witnesses.
If it were all legit, of course, you'd want the opposite. You want there to be more witnesses, more photographers, more records, more details, not less.
Yeah, so there's some high degree of security, and obviously it's officially denied by the police later on that it happened. But the important thing is the initial reports which came out, I think in New Zealand newspapers or something, said that the people shot down had been wearing bombs. Now, what that means is that that was the rationale given for the Kratos protocol to be activated, that the claim is made, and obviously there wouldn't have been any more than, just like Demendez's. If you remember the story with Demendez's on the 22nd, there was the pretense that he was wearing some sort of bulky coat which might have had bombs underneath it.
Just look at the absurdity of this, because... if these guys were the suicide bombers, they'd already ignited their bombs and they were already dead.
Exactly.
So how absurd could it be that they're actually being killed on Canary Wharf in relation to the official story? So, of course, the police are therefore going to want to obfuscate what happened at Canary Wharf.
Okay, now, it's immediately after that shooting that the story of bombs going off appears. It's important to understand this. In the early, say, 2 hours after the event, it was all about a power surge. The London Underground had experienced a power surges that had somehow caused disaster, okay? And it wasn't until these three or maybe four were out of the way, in other words, not around to contradict the story, that the story of bombers on the train suddenly appeared. When the bus blew up, that became the template image of a bomb going off, and people then started to say that bombs had gone off on the London Underground.
So you're telling me, Nick, they couldn't afford to run the story of the four suicide bombers until they were sure they were dead?
Yeah, well, they didn't become suicide bombers for quite a while, generally, but yeah, that is so. The first story of a suicide bomber, somebody pretending to have seen him, comes on the bus. A very suspicious character called Richard Jones claims to have seen Hasip Hussein on the lower deck fiddling about with his rucksack. And his account of Hasip Hussein keeps changing and doesn't at all resemble the pictures we have of him. And then later on he was supposed to have been on the upper deck and not the lower deck. But that kind of bogus testimony, clearly fraudulent, becomes... the initial story of a suicide bomber, which then takes a hold some days later. Yeah.
Oh, boy. So how far have you been able to carry your analysis of terror on the tube, Nick, prior to the inquest, which convinced you that Maud Dibb had got it right?
Well, I think the story is developing, and we need to have the humility to admit that we may not have got it right at first, and collectively try and follow it as best we can. For example, 9/11 was a fourfold event. You had four events happening, ostensibly, and one, three close together, one an hour later in time.
Yes.
And this is a bit similar pattern to what we get here.
That's right. You have four events, yes.
Yeah, and at Madrid, you get four trains blowing up. 9/11 begins at 8:45, which is a very similar time to this. And let's notice, we noticed some in-depth rehearsals of what was to take place. The primary imagination for what happened on July the 7th was done on a panorama program in 14 months earlier. And there, you had three bombs going off, a bit around 8 o'clock in the morning on the central London Underground, okay, and one above ground an hour later. Now, that was a BBC panorama story. It was presented as a docudrama, and it had Peter Power, this the top British sort of terror czar giving the narrative, okay? So, it told us, quote, that this event was set in the future, but only just. So, this was a docudrama that was kind of meant to be real and was in fact a blueprint of what happened on July the 7th, okay?
Yes.
Now we then get details of something April of 2005, which is an American-British collaboration called Atlantic Blue. It was called the British section, and that was a terrific rehearsal for a terrorist attacks upon UK transport network coinciding with a major international summit. Okay, now that, as we know, was happening at the time up in Scotland at Gleneagles, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard. It's top secrecy what happened there. It was a huge exercise, drill, dress rehearsal, all echelons of government involved. And it's very hard to get any... Then top secrecy was then imposed afterwards, what happened. But we do gather that it involved simulating four terrorist bombs going off at once across London. This came out reported in a British newspaper. So there again, you get the blueprint of four terrorist bombs going off at once across London in their game rehearsal. Okay, and it's terribly important for us to appreciate how a game rehearsal transforms into the real thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Now we get one last drill. I could just tell you that Exercise Atlantic Blue had an American contingent called Top Off 3, and overall it was called Global Shield, and Canada was also involved. So it's a big sort of global event. Now, recently, the July the 7th team that I mentioned earlier have discovered that the British police hold a yearly terror drill practice, okay? And it's called Operation Hanover, and guess what? For the year 2005, they held it just a few days before July the 7th, on the 1st and 2nd of July. And this seems to have been threefold. It was, quote, three simultaneous bomb attacks on three underground stations. Now, is that a coincidence or what? You've got simultaneous bomb attacks on three London underground trains, at train stations. And the police report on this said, the fact that it took place so close to the actual attacks is an interesting coincidence. Well, all these practice events are not just interesting coincidences. They are the rehearsals for what then becomes real.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, I think we need to understand...
They're simulating it to make sure there aren't any major kinks they've overlooked.
Yeah, I think with 9/11, you've been discovering a whole lot of war games going on just around the time.
Well, Webster Tarpley talks about as many as 17 anti-terrorist drills that were taking place on the morning of 9/11 that it had the effect of guaranteeing there'd be no American military response to the reports of hijacked aircraft.
Right, yeah. So when something's happening, it looks as if it's part of the terror drill. And also people who are preparing for it can look as if, can say they're just part of a terror drill, and so I think these rehearsals are something the inquest ought really to investigate, because it's mathematically impossible that you can have these three simultaneous bomb attacks on the underground and one above ground continually rehearsed, and it then happens.
Yes.
It's a bit like you know that film, V for Vendetta?
Yes.
That was about a London Underground train blowing up, okay?
Right.
Now, that was filmed on the London Underground in the months leading up to July the 7th, okay? From March 2005 up until June, they were filming V for Vendetta. This is Warner Brothers, right?
Yes.
So you get Warner Brothers, all these top, sort of film people, allowed access... And there's parliamentary debate about all the access they've been allowed all over the place. This story, there is an American contingent to the July the 7th story. The American intelligence and American news keep announcing what happened or explaining what happened in a way that should leave us rather puzzled. But I think, again, Warner Brothers, and then the launch of V for Vendetta had to be postponed, because after July the 7th happened, being rather similar and reminiscent of the plot of V for Vendetta, with an underground train made to blow up, that launch all around the world had to be postponed until the year after. Again, I suggest that this could be part of a dress rehearsal that goes on.
The filming could have been used as a cover planning of the events of 7/7.
Yeah, I think we need to understand that the New World Order has these docudramas and territory rehearsals in just the same way as it has its number games, that these are the signature of who's doing it.
Very clever, isn't it? Very clever.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me just say a couple words, Nick, here. This is also blatant. This is also obvious. Every intelligence service in the world has to know that these bombings, the Madrid bombings, 7/7 and 9/11, were all arranged, and that the governments of the countries were complicit. Certainly that's true in the U.S. Certainly that's true in the U.K. Whether it's also true in Spain is, to me, an open question. But there would be nothing surprising if it turned out to be the case that was so.
Yeah. I think with Spain, we're digressing a bit. I think there were stories about the people arrested as perpetrators had the telephone numbers of various members of government security, and they had this high-powered explosive, which the normal Spanish terrorists couldn't have got. I think those are
like
the kind of
like the military grade on 7/7.
They had the military grade. Yeah. So it's a great pity that the British people don't seem prepared to have a real inquiry, answer these questions that are
the British,
so important.
Is the British population as conditioned as the American by our news media and our government to not address these issues in a serious fashion? I mean, you know, is it all papered over as much in your country as
well,
it is
Jim,
mine?
I think there's a big difference. In your country, you've got, I believe, something like 40% of the population believes there's something funny about the 9/11 story.
Yeah, maybe
believe
more.
Believe the governments have not told the truth, maybe more. I mean, is that up to 50% or what?
I think it's probably right about that.
Right, okay. Well, it depends exactly what question you ask, of course. But
yeah,
let's say 40, 50%. Now, in this country, it's only a tiny proportion doubt the official story. With Muslims, it's said to be about one-third.
With Muslims, it's only one-third?
Only, that's what I've heard. But well, hang on. I've heard other accounts that it's higher with Muslims. But
haven't they been watching Maud Dib? Of course, if they're not even going to turn up for my symposium at Friend's house, when they've been solicited...
Well, I've asked Maud Dib. I said, I'd love to hear a story of a school or of any Muslim group where his film had been shown, and a response of people discussing it, or school kids in these schools packed with Muslims. I think they'd love to. They'd be thrilled to hear that. And he said he didn't know of any. There's only one occasion I've heard, and that is at the Birmingham Mosque, you know, the wise old Imam of Birmingham Mosque showed that film, and then he said virtually everyone in his mosque, you know, agreed that, you know, with the
It's such a brilliant piece of work. I mean, it makes it crystal clear exactly what happened and the Peter Powers, you know, central role in all of this. I mean, it's so blatant.
Well, yeah. There's been no poll to show what proportion of British people or British Muslims take this view, and it might be as little as 5% of the British people, maybe 10. So you see, with 9/11, there was a big breakthrough with I think it was with Loose Change, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Got it across, got the message across, big time.
Yeah.
And Moore Dib is, I think, he's having some effect. But for example, there's a this July 7th research group totally slags off Moore Dib in a rather stupid manner, but they say they're against his video because it's too speculative.
Is this Ian Henshaw?
No, this is a group called himself July 7th Truth campaign, which I've alluded to once or twice here, and they've been going for a few years.
Who runs the shop?
Well, it's a bit sort of anonymous group in a way. There's no particularly eminent person doing it. But if you put in July 7th Truth, it'll come up.
What you're telling me really is this is a group created to manage research on 9/11, not to pursue it.
Well, it could sound like that, yeah. But they never reach. They object to what I'm doing, and they never want to reach any sort of conclusion at all. Like they discovered what I mentioned about the Jaguar at Luton. That's quite a nice discovery. But they don't like to put the story together or take any overall view.
Look, the objective of disinformation is not to convince you of one point of view or another. It's to create enough uncertainty that everything is believable and nothing is knowable. What you're telling me is that's precisely the function being filled by this unit, this entity, which I say without any hesitation is promoting disinformation.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, Jim. I like that definition of the aim of disinformation. Yeah, it sounds like the sophists. I think of them as like the sophists. When in Socrates' time, when he was trying to ascertain what was what, his kind of enemies or opponents were the sophists, who were very well informed, but would just frivolously dismiss any particular view.
Well, the sophists were akin with used car salesmen. They were masters of rhetoric. They felt they could convince anyone of anything at any time. Socrates, however, represented the antithesis because he was devoted to the pursuit of truth. And I'd say here, in relation to this group and you and Maudib, are the Socratic students and the others are the sophists.
Well, thank you, Jim. Right.
Well, you deserve it, Nick.
I think that we do have to. The survival of our civilization does depend on being able to find our way through the official illusion that we're given. It's a very extraordinary new millennium that we never expected to be in, where authority gives us massive untruth, and the purpose of untruth is to extinguish hope and create fear and allow wars to take place. It's supremely important that we exercise whatever faculty we may have, collectively possible, to see what really is and what is behind what the government is giving us.
Excellent statements, Nick. We're going to use those occasion as the occasion for our final break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, about to conclude a fascinating conversation with Nick Kollerstrom about the inquest in the UK on 7/7. We'll be right back.
Stem cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, concluding my conversation with Nick Kullerstrom, a historian of science, the author of Terror on the Tube, and our man at the inquest on 7-7, who has become convinced by testimony and videos he has seen there that he has been able to assess that Maud Dibb's story of what happened on 7-7 is right on the mark. Mm-hmm. I find this quite fascinating, Nick, because I know you to be a serious scholar, and you don't treat these matters lightly. You're very thorough and painstaking, so I'm very impressed by what you're telling me and how it's affected your own thinking about the matter.
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a shock to modify my view from what I published, but I think we're in a kind of new phase now where we've got a closer focus on this.
Well, let me make an obvious point about the nature of rationality of belief. It's essential to rationality that your views be based upon the available relevant evidence, and when new evidence that's relevant becomes available and makes a difference, the only rational response is to modify your beliefs, which you have done, but which I dare say many won't. I mean, I know in JFK research, a fellow who published a very important book back in 1967 based upon the Zapruder film, yeah, has been unwilling to modify his then belief that the film was authentic because it would largely invalidate his book, which was based upon a frame-by-frame study of the film. So he's resisted a mass of evidence, very powerful, very convincing, that the current film is a recreation, a fabrication, a fake, Work that appears in all three of my books on JFK and Assassination Science, Murder in Dealey Plaza, and the Great Zapruder Film Hoax, but also corroborated by work by the Assassination Records Review Board that's been distilled in a series of publications by Douglas Horn entitled Inside the ARRB, where anyone who would like an article that summarizes some of the ARRB's most significant findings can find it under the heading U.S. Government Official JFK Cover-Up Film Fabrication. Nick, tell us more. I'm very interested in, how this affects your general view of what goes on in the world and whether there's more to 7-7 here that we should consider within a broader compass.
Well, Jim, I believe we want to try and live in a civilization in which people do not live in fear all the time and do not live in fear of their neighbors. And we've had the official government fear alert, or how frightened you're supposed to, threat level assessment, they call it, put up to maximum about a month ago. And this happened again at the beginning of the year, as if they're waiting for, or trying to invoke something terrible, that something terrible is going to happen, and telling you that a new Al-Qaeda threat is imminent and so forth. Nothing much happens, okay? We're up to maximum level. All they seem to come up with is this very absurd thing, airport scare a few days before the American elections about a toner cartridge come out of Yemen, which is, I think it's an extremely absurd story.
Yes.
And I think the only possible relevance to the July 7th story is that the Israeli government is claiming to have knowledge of it a day before everyone else had heard of it. This is, I think it's something allegedly bound for synagogues in Chicago, is that right?
Yes.
And somehow it goes via a British airport, and British experts spent 6 hours examining this thing, a toner cartridge, and said they did not think it was a bomb. And then, after that, President Obama made some comment that, yes, it was dangerous, and they had to then modify the story that it was some sort of terror threat.
Well, bear in mind that Obama's, subject to manipulation as much as anyone else by being fed false information. It's very unfortunate, but there it is.
Yeah.
In fact, then, in sending the 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, he said it was because that was the region from which we were attacked, which was false, and he was there in pursuit of Osama bin Laden, who appears to have died on or about 15 December 2001. So it appears that either our president is seriously misinformed or he's concealing the truth from the American public. Either way, we're not in very good hands.
Yeah, well, let's hope that a new generation of politicians arises, like Cynthia McKinney in America, who are capable of understanding the things that you just said, Jim. I think they're very fundamental and should be obvious, but
well, it's embarrassing. I was a strong supporter of this guy. I sent him $100 five different times, and it wasn't the same $100, Nick, during his campaign. I believed in him, and I have become very disillusioned because of the things he hasn't done, such as rescind the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, close Guantanamo, get us out of these misconceived wars in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and even the U.S. Constitution. He has to have done more. I think he suffered at the polls here just this week because he was too timid, not because he did too much, but because he did too little. Too little.
People
and because he sought to accommodate these ruthless Republicans who don't want anything that benefits the American people, but only actions that benefit the very rich,
to take place.
Yeah. It's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's not turning out to be our knight on a white stallion. I mean, I wanted to believe he was, but now he seems too much of a milquetoast. It's very disappointing.
Well, they said that after that historic speech he gave at Cairo, in which he said that good relations and collaboration with the Islamic world were quite possible, that the American media turned against him then, that was a kind of turning point for him.
Repeat that, Nick. The turning point was...
After he gave his historic speech at Cairo saying that collaboration and friendship with the Islamic world was possible for America...
Of course.
That the American American media turned against establishment turned against him. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Obama, you know, he has so much potential, but I think at this point now we can see he's being manipulated. It's ridiculous and unfortunate.
Yeah. Okay, well, both our countries have sort of terror alerts or five different levels that government puts out about how scared you're supposed to be.
You have them too. I didn't know had the similar. Yeah, we have these color coded.
Yeah, I think the top level means you just stay indoors and draw the curtains.
Whenever Bush needed a little bump in politics, you know, they'd put out another terror alert, they'd raise it. It was so artificial, Nick. The pattern was so predictable. It was disgusting.
Well, these started here in the wake of the July the 7th event that it became possible to do this. I think now this very absurd airport scare... of a toner cartridge, which British authorities, British experts said was not a bomb, and was then said it had to be one. This is all they've been able to come out with, and the link of Israeli Mossad involvement is openly stated in this by Israelis claiming they knew about it one day before everyone else did.
Yeah, well, Israelis know about these things in advance of anyone else because they plan most of them.
Yeah, well, this is it. I think false flag terror.
That's their area of specialization, Nick. If they were getting a PhD, that would be their dissertation subject and their special area for examination. Yeah. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, the whole formation of Israel involves use of terror and deception.
Bombing the King David Hotel, one example, but all kinds of slaughters. Yeah. I mean, this is their history. You know, because of my visits to Buenos Aires in 2008 and 2009, I came into contact with Adrian Salbucci, who knows a great deal about the attacks on the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires and subsequently the Jewish Community Center in 1992 and 1994. Apparently, the first bombing didn't have enough of an effect, so they went back and slaughtered some more civilians of their own faith in order to make it more dramatic. This is because Argentina was engaged in the development of nuclear power with Iran.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they wanted to stop that.
They wanted to stop that. It was all very...
Which they did. They did succeed in stopping that. I just wish that we could get some decent documentary evidence out for what you discovered with those Buenos Aires attacks. I think they're so...
If you Google false flag attacks... Mm-hmm. You know, 1992-1994, you're going to find that an interview I did with Adrian on this very show
was turned into an article. But that's all there is, your interview with Sam Butch.
And
it's very good.
Published on VoltaireNet,
But it'd be nice to have, if anyone's going to dredge up a bit of original evidence for that day, what happened.
Yeah. Oh, it was really quite blatant. I mean, you know, you get into the details there, and they're just as ridiculous as the details about 7/7.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's really counting on, you know, the press and their ability to manipulate the news and the information that the public receives. It's very
useful. Well, it seems to me that with this, there are quite a few key people who are shut up by the authorities. They're shut up and got out of the way. And if we could only hear their testimony, it would be very crucial. I'll give you an example. In this inquest, there's a whole lot of alleged evidence of the four, or three of these lads, and what they call the bomb factory, which is a place in Leeds, 18 Alexandra Road, where they claim to be manufacturing the bombs, okay, and making up the peroxide, and the police probably planted a whole lot of evidence there, or alleged it's there, alleged receipts, alleged phone calls, and so forth. Now, the point is, there was an Egyptian PhD who was working at Leeds University who was renting this flat. Okay, Magzi al-Nashar, and he left 2 days before July the 7th, and he flew out to Cairo in Egypt. So it was his flat. And so clearly, if all this stuff had been going on, which the inquest is alleging, of the four coming and going, and loads of hydrogen peroxide being brought into the flat, and so on, this fellow would have been arrested and he'd be in jail. They found this fellow in Cairo. They arrested him, the British police, okay? They confiscated his laptop, and they found his laptop was full of music, okay? not Al-Qaeda addresses, not bomb-making recipes, but music, classical music. So they let him off.
Nick, I lost half of your sentence there. So they let him off?
They let him off without any charges. So that was the first person they'd been able to arrest in connection with the crime of July the 7th. This Magdi al-Nashar in Cairo, they arrested him and they had to let him go free because they had no charges against him. And what that means is that there wasn't really anything of an incriminating nature at his flat, 18 Alexandra Road in Leeds. If there had been, he'd have been prosecuted.
Yes, sure.
So with a load of evidence, the police are spinning now about hydrogen peroxide manufacture and stuff, which is chemically totally impossible. These four lads had no interest whatever in chemistry. Nobody's got any evidence they're ever interested in chemistry. And certainly if they had bought some peroxide from a hair bleach chemistry shop or chemist or whatever, there's no way that by boiling it on a saucepan, they could distill it up to the 70% which you require for a bomb.
Nick, we ought to mention that you have a background with regard to chemistry, so that your remarks here are not in any way guesswork, that you know whereof you speak.
Well, yeah, okay, I've got a Cambridge science degree, and perhaps more relevant, I used to have a chemistry set when I was a kid, and I used to try making things that blew up.
I love it!
So I can tell the utter baloney when they come out with these peroxide stories. Fake, the bogus terror stories always have bottles of hydrogen peroxide, which are found by the police, as if they could be used for making a bomb. I mean, as if what happened on the London Underground could be done with a home peroxide, you know, still.
Yeah.
It's just that very height of absurdity. It really is the limit of absurdity. By boiling hydrogen peroxide, you're not going to concentrate it. You need special chemical apparatus, fractional distillation at low pressure. That's what a chemist told me. Low pressure fractional distillation to get up to the 70% of explosive level at which you can make a peroxide bomb. And this inquest, can you believe it? The inquest has reiterated the final story of what the bombs consisted of. And this came out in 2008 as black pepper and hydrogen peroxide.
Good now, God.
A lot of people thought this was some sort of joke or something that wouldn't be repeated. Because, as you probably remember, the real experts, in the wake of the London bombings, in the first few days, were saying this is military-grade explosive, something called C4, which is made in NATO laboratories.
Right.
And to end up with saying that it's black pepper and hydrogen peroxide made up in Leeds is an extreme limit of absurdity, okay?
I agree.
And we really need the testimony of Magdi al-Nashar, if anybody could possibly get hold of him in Cairo, but somebody, an informed source told me he would have been intimidated by the British police through the Egyptian police to keep absolutely silent, probably threats on his family and so on. But his testimony would sort out, because he was renting that place from a local housing co-op, and his testimony would clarify in what way any of those lads might have come to that flat. It's claimed that I think three of them did. I think Magdi al-Nashar knew one of them. I think he knew Jermaine Lindsay, and he might have been introduced to Hasib Hussain. And I think some comments he regarded them as being innocent. But that's an example of one fellow. If we could get his testimony, I think it would throw a lot of light on the government story. The fact that we never hear from him at all, I think, is indicative, you know?
Of course, yeah.
So he's a PhD.
Let me draw another parallel in relation to the FBI's management of Warren Commission testimony. The 10 witnesses closest to the limousine in which JFK was assassinated were never called to testify. Those who were in the vicinity, who had important information, were asked about trivialities and not allowed to testify about what they knew that was most important. And then if any of their evidence actually got into the record about important matters where they gave testimony, it was altered. I mean, this is the way in which they operate. It's unbelievable. It's disgusting when you consider that you're entrusting an agency like the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Nick. Think of the title, how imposing.
Yeah.
But they spend more time covering up crimes on behalf of the administration than they do investigating them.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. I found this true in the death of Senator Paul Wellstone, whose loss of life led to the Republicans taking control of the United States Senate in 2002.
To
pass legislation or support, at least passively, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Wow. So I hadn't realized it was so strategic.
He had to be
bumped off to get the Congress to support the war.
That's right. He was the most outspoken critic, and Dick Cheney warned him that if he opposed them on Iraq, that he would that there would be severe ramifications for him personally and for the state of Minnesota. He did oppose them on Iraq. He did confide in veterans at Wilmer that Cheney had given him this threat. And the next thing we know, 10 days before the election, he is dead.
Yeah. Hmm.
And I've done a huge amount of research on this thing, Nick, I'll just tell you.
Yes, I remember you investigated the beam weapon that was used to bring down
the
plane.
It does appear to have been an electromagnetic weapon that overwhelmed the electrical system and flipped the solenoids that control the pitch of the props onto idle. And took out the communications equipment and a whole lot of other stuff. But it's interesting. You can find it in the book I published, co-authored with a Native American scholar by the name of Don Foros Jacobs, American Assassination. You can find statements I gave at the National Press Club when we released the book 2 years to the day after his death on assassinationscience.com. And perhaps even more importantly, an article I co-authored with John P. Costella, a PhD from Australia with a specialty in electromagnetism, who discovered evidence in the official records that confirmed our belief that it was done using an electromagnetic weapon in a study entitled The NTSB Failed Wellstone, which is on the same website, assassinationscience.com. Michael Rupert, Nick, published that in his newsletter called From the Wilderness.
Right.
But Rupert had independently been pursuing this case, and in his book, Crossing the Rubicon, he explained how an insider who actually worked for the agency had told him it was a hit, and that there was a group of reinvigorated old white guys who were in charge. They were no one to screw around with, and you could bet there would be other strategic accidents that would take place in the future.
Yeah, but let's focus on this fairly exotic technology of a beam weapon bringing down a plane. I think the New World Order does have these kind of advanced weaponry, and does enjoy using it. And it sometimes seems to me that what happened in these blasts did have sort of unusual aspects to it that were not very clear exactly what did happen or what was used.
Military weapons development is about two decades ahead of what the public is allowed to know of, and only now are they talking about some of these types of weapons, which have apparently been in use in Iraq. But at the time I was doing that research on Wellstone, before we published the book in 2004, I had discovered the existence of the Directed Energy Professional Society, Nick, which was that year having its 8th annual meeting in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Oh, yeah. All right.
And when you looked at, the sections of the society, they were devoted to all these different types of directed energy weapons.
Yes. Well, if I may make a rather tentative comment, in looking at the evidence, the experience of the people around when the bombs went off, it keeps not sounding as if bombs went off, as if something rather strange happened, and what people experienced was, for example, flames outside the carriage they saw, flames going along the side of the wall,
Electrical phenomenon.
Yeah, a bit like sort of some sort of cold electrical fire, getting electrically frazzled, as if some terrific electrical surge was passing.
Did any of the passengers have kinds of injuries that were induced by electricity?
I'm not sure about that.
That might be worth contemplating.
Yes.
There was a woman, a cancer researcher in New Orleans, who appears to have been killed by an electrical discharge from a linear particle accelerator. And her body was found back in her apartment, but half of her right arm and half of her torso had been burned off by a tremendous, quantity of electricity. I mean, the voltage had to be stunning.
Yeah. Huh.
So these things can happen. I'm just curious whether there might be any residual signs. I think you make a most interesting suggestion. I realize it's tentative and hypothetical on your part that you offer it, but it is an very interesting idea, Nick. And as you know from the study of the history of science, it's getting ideas out there that's the hard part. It's, you know, being able to fashion the hypotheses. Once we have the hypotheses, it's not so hard to sort them out in relation to the evidence, except in cases where you have to sort out the authentic from the inauthentic, and in this case, the suppression.
Well, I think the starting point here is the fact that all three coaches on the trains that blew up could not be shown to any member of the public or any journalist or any film crew, right? They had to be hustled away, covered up, taken away, and a year later they were destroyed. There's destruction of the vital scene of the crime without anyone seeing it. That's what the British police did.
What could be more blatant, obviously, that the evidence from the cars themselves wouldn't justify or support the official police story. This is ridiculous. In Los Angeles, get this, Nick, in Los Angeles, when after Bobby was assassinated, and I've done a recent study entitled RFK Outing the CIA at the Ambassador, the police, confronted with the existence of more bullet holes in the room, in the pantry, than could have come from Sirhan's gun, dismantled the pantry, and they subsequently destroyed all the evidence on the ground that it wouldn't fit into a 3x5 card file.
Yeah, well, there you go, right. Just to complete what I was saying, some of your listeners will have seen some pictures of the coaches. I think that they had all of the, for example, the windows taken out, the windows totally removed, from the coaches before you could have any photograph allowed. So you simply see straight through to the walls of the underground. That may be, I suggest, because the windows were blown inwards.
Yes.
They imploded.
Yes.
Various people had bits of glass stuck into them.
Yes.
Due to the implosion that took place. I think that could be why we weren't allowed any picture of the coach.
Could be the blast consuming so much oxygen in such a short piece of time created a vacuum that brought the windows inside the cars?
Well, possibly. I just don't know.
Or the extra of the blast going out and around the cars pushed them in from the outside.
That's the way I would tend to see it.
As they were in a tube, as in when you say terror in the tube.
Yeah, they were in the underground, and it appears rather more spread out. The accounts of people who are injured appears rather more spread out than it ought to have done if a single suicide bomb had caused the event.
And of course, if the bomb had been inside the train, obviously inside the cars, it would have blown the windows outward. Whereas if the bomb's outside and under the train, then if it's in a tunnel, a confined space, then the pressure can very easily blow the windows in. That's a very nice point. So again, we find the evidence, you know, even the concealed evidence seems to contradict the official account. Nick, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. Your diligence, dedication, and intelligence make you a sensational resource for discussing these issues, and I look forward to it.
It's a pleasure, Jim. It's a pleasure.
I look forward to having you back, my friend. Keep up the great work.
Okay, cheers.
Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Nick Kohlerstrom. Go to his website, terrorontheTube.co.uk, and check it out. Thank you all for listening.
Imagine she's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Imagine she's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Majesty's a pretty nice girl. Someday I'm gonna make her mine. Oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make her mine.
Veer Radio is listener supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll-free call-in number, and our website, free MP3 archive links, and interactive forums.